The Saratoga Performing Arts Center is presenting its very first speaker series, where attendees will sit in the orchestra chairs on the main stage of the SPAC Amphitheater while renowned guest speakers lead talks from the conductor's podium on a variety of topics that bridge the worlds of art, science, and nature. The first event for speakers at SPAC, Earth and Other Worlds, is a conversation with Dava Sobel and Diane Ackerman. Dava Sobel is a science writer and author of Galileo's Daughter and the Glass Universe. Diane Ackerman is a poet, science writer, and author of A Natural History of the Senses, The Human Age, and, of course, The Zookeeper's Wife. Again, the event takes place Thursday, August 9th at 8 p.m., and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dava Sobel to the roundtable this morning. Dava, thank you very much for being with us. Always a delight to speak with you.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Of course, a science writer, author of Galileo's Daughter and the Glass Universe, among other works. What do you find fascinating about the idea of this conversation?
I love the fact that I'll be there with my poet friend, Diane Ackerman. We have had several adventures together over the years. I first met her when she was a graduate student at Cornell, writing a cycle of poems about the solar system, and having Carl Sagan on her graduate committee and interviewing him every day for real information about the solar system that she incorporated into her poetry. And at that time, I was the science writer in the news bureau at Cornell, so Sagan was one of the people I spoke to on a regular basis, and I was as delighted as he was that somebody was really turning science into poetry. And we went on an eclipse expedition once in 1991. There was a very spectacular eclipse because of the length of time of totality. And we were on a ship together. Mm. We were both on assignment for a magazine. And Diane wrote a poem about the eclipse, and I wrote an article about the adventure of taking a trip like that and seeing a total solar eclipse for the first time. So when we are together at SPAC, we'll be talking about the language of science, the language of poetry, how poetry can illuminate science. Who knows where the conversation will go from there, but I'm excited to see.
Does the language of science, do you believe, transfer well to the language of poetry?
I think the feelings transfer. A lot of people think of science as an accumulation of facts, which it is not. It's really about a bunch of people who have tremendous passion and curiosity and throw themselves at the world trying to figure it out. And that's what poets do, too. So I think at the heart of it, there's more similarity than difference. And I'm somewhere in the middle because I'm certainly not a poet. But I like to push the language when I'm trying to explain science for readers who would not consider themselves scientists and maybe not even identify themselves as people who are interested in science. But I believe there is something fundamentally interesting about the scientific process and scientific discovery, and I'm always writing about that in one form or another.
Give us an idea of the maturation process in your writing career, of coming to a point where you were comfortable and natural in finding that language to describe what often is very complex in science.
I think the fact that I started off as a newspaper reporter was really helpful to me because I was talking to scientists a lot and asking them about their work and having to ask questions that sometimes made me feel stupid, so that I would be able to explain it, to turn around and explain it again to someone else. And I think that's the nature of writing, that it's when you sit down to write something that you discover how much you don't know or how much you don't understand. It really forces you to face that and to go back and ask more questions or do more reading to bring your knowledge up to a point where you can be trusted to write for a wider audience. And in that work, I also learned to go back to the scientists with anything that I had written to make sure that I translated it correctly, because it's hard to hear something for the first time and report it accurately. That is not a normal course of events. Usually if you've just learned something and you try to report it, you'll get some aspect of it wrong. So I always did that. I always went back to the scientist saying something like, I don't want you to really comment on my writing style, but is this a fair representation of your work? And they were grateful. And I continued doing that even at the New York Times when I worked there. And I always remember one day my editor caught me on the phone reading my article aloud, or sections of it, reading it aloud to the scientist I had interviewed, and taking me aside later and saying, you know, reporters don't really do that. And I thought, well, maybe political reporters don't do that. But in science, I felt it was essential.
In the writing and in your understanding, there also, it seems to me, there has to be great curiosity, that you have to, A, care, and also know, have the ability to be very curious about what is involved in a particular topic and subject.
Yeah, I think really loving the subject is important for me. And now, at my age, I'm 71 now, I have, most of the time, I have the luxury of choosing the subjects I am most interested in, and those mostly have to do with astronomy. The scientists working in that field are full of curiosity and excitement, and anytime I talk to them, I'm aware of that and energized by it.
At the risk of leading the witness, do you think we as a culture and a society at this particular moment are curious enough about science?
No. I feel there's a dangerous anti-science sentiment abroad in the land, fueled by misconceptions about what science is, how the scientific process works. I feel that at the highest reaches of our government, there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the scientific process, and I worry about that.
For those of us who are worried about it, what do you believe can be done to at least make ourselves feel a little bit better?
Well, I think we have to keep doing science. As a radio broadcaster, I as a writer, nonfiction writer, have to keep saying what we know and believe to be true, and keeping our interest in science attractive to other people instead of off-putting. I think if one gets into an argument and one tries to say something like, well, I know about the facts of science, therefore you're an idiot, that's not going to get us anywhere. I think it's also important to point out that science and religious beliefs are not mutually exclusive, that I know numerous scientists, including astronomers, who have a deep religious faith, but it does not keep them from using the scientific method and pursuing a real understanding of the world around them.
Recently, there was a story that made news, and there was a beautiful piece about it in the New York Times about Mars and life on Mars. When you read a story or you see a story like that, is your reaction of, oh, I knew that, or is it one of still of wonder?
Well, both. I've been reading about the presence of water on Mars for a long time. Even as long ago as 1996, there was a meteorite discovered in Antarctica that had come from Mars and had evidence in it of something that looked like a primitive form of microbe. And that got a lot of people excited that maybe there was on Mars, when it was a wet world, the beginnings of life, maybe even life as we know it. And all people are curious, is there life somewhere else? Are we the only ones? It is a giant question that everyone would like to know the answer to, but we don't have an answer. So looking at other planets of the solar system, the moons of some of the other planets are water worlds now. They have icy surfaces and liquid water underneath, and we just don't know if there's anything alive in that water. But it is of paramount interest to scientists, and it's one of the reasons they want to send missions to the outer planets or going back to Mars. Mars wouldn't be considered an outer planet, but the moons of Jupiter, moons of Saturn are fascinating places and might give us a clue to begin to answer that big question about life elsewhere.
Your last book was The Glass Universe that was published in 2016. What's next for you?
Right now I'm working on a radio series about the sun for the BBC World Service, which is keeping me very busy until I come up with a good idea for another book, which I don't have yet. I'm not being coy. If I had an idea, I would tell you, because I would want to tell other people, please don't try to do this yourself, because I want to do it.
And I guess the natural question I would have is, would you write about the sun?
If I had... I think it's too soon. I think it's a good time for a radio series because we're about to launch, the United States is about to launch a major new probe, the Parker Solar Probe, which will get so close to the sun that it will be able to answer questions people have had for a long time. And those answers will be coming down for years. I think the subject is it's too hot for a book, let me put it that way, because a book takes a long time. Even when you finish writing it, the time between completion of a manuscript and the book's publication, months go by, things change. Radio is much more flexible of the moment.
The Speakers at SPAC series Earth and Other Worlds takes place Thursday, August 9th at 8 p.m., a conversation with Dava Sobel and Diane Ackerman. You can find out more information about the series and about the event by going to SPAC.org, S-P-A-C, SPAC.org. Dava Sobel, a great pleasure as always to speak with you. Thank you very much, and we look forward to having you in the region.
Thank you, Joe. I look forward to it, too.
Thank you very much. Again, a conversation with Dava Sobel and Diane Ackerman, speakers at SPAC, Earth and Other Worlds, SPAC.org for more information. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.